This is Jeffrey Sachs, editor of Tradition, and our recently released Rabbi Norman Lam Memorial Volume. I look forward to bringing you the Tradition podcast every few weeks, but I'm also hoping that you will subscribe to Tradition to get everything that we have to offer in our print journal. Becoming a subscriber is the only way to make sure you don't miss the best writing in the Orthodox Jewish world on the most timely and timeless topics. To subscribe, please visit our website, traditiononline.org, to get delivery of the quarterly journal and digital access to all the content in our archives, from the moment Rabbi Lam founded Tradition in 1958, right up to our most recent issue. That's 64 years of our community's most incisive, impactful, and reflective writing and scholarship. In this episode of the podcast, I speak with Dr. Erica Brown and Professor Ari Goldman about their contributions to the Rabbi Lam Memorial Volume. They each wrote about aspects of Rabbi Lam's written record as a self-styled, unrepentant darshan, one of the Jewish 20th century's peerless rhetoricians who turned the synagogue sermon into an art form and used the power of his pulpit to communicate an array of messages and educate his flock in a most impactful way. They also shared with us how Rabbi Lam's teachings helped shape their own religious worldviews and have had profound personal effects on each of them. I should mention our gratitude to the Lam Heritage Archives, housed on the website of Yeshiva University, which has digitized hundreds of speeches and sermons. It's a great resource for your weekly study of the parasha and, you shouldn't be surprised, is sourced in almost every one of the 35 essays in the Memorial Volume. Dr. Erica Brown is a well-known author and public speaker and a consulting editor at Tradition. She is the director of the Mayberg Center for Jewish Education and Leadership at George Washington University. Ari Goldman is a professor of journalism at Columbia University. Some may remember him as the longtime religion reporter for the New York Times and the author of The Search for God at Harvard, among his other books. Here's our conversation. Welcome to the Tradition Podcast, Dr. Erica Brown and Professor Ari Goldman. Both of you contributed essays to the Rabbi Norman Lam Memorial Volume recently issued by Tradition. 35 essays by our community's leading lights, our educators, our teachers, our rabbis, and a very good number of members of the Lam family who have gone on to do impressive work in the Jewish world in their own right. And we were very glad to involve them in this book because of the unimaginable double loss of Rabbi and Mrs. Lam within just a few weeks of each other during the corona epidemic. Ari, you are a member of that legacy, the Lam family. You're a nephew of Rabbi and Mrs. Lam. And in your essay, you write about a particular volume of Rabbi Lam's Sermons for Yizkor. But you're not writing as some kind of removed, dispassionate scholar. You're writing as somebody who heard many of those sermons and drashot sitting in Manhattan. Tell us about your relationship with the Lams, and tell us a little bit about that experience of being quite a young boy listening to some of those sermons, mipi ha-gvura, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Well, I grew up on the Upper West Side and went to the Jewish Center from the time of my bar mitzvah. Before that, I lived in Hartford, Connecticut, and I lived in Queens, but then soon after my bar mitzvah, I moved with my family to the Upper West Side, just a few blocks from the Jewish Center. And of course, we were regulars there. And as a young teen, I didn't want to sit for the sermon, but my mother said, "Sit, you know, you can't go out, you'll learn something." And it's usually break time, but I sat and I learned, I didn't always grasp the concepts, but I just heard the language, the words just sort of washed over me, the emotions, the wisdom. And it made a great impression on me and made me want to stay and made me understand more and more each week. So yes, when reviewing this volume of his Yizkor sermons, they were familiar. I remember them as a kid, even though I left for Yizkor, that I was allowed to leave for. I had to stay for the sermon before Yizkor. So they made a great impression on me. And being his nephew, I was really a Ben Byatt in the Lamb house. I came and went as I needed, as I pleased. I was single for well after my teens. I got married in my 30s, and my 20s, I would just drop in. I had this joke with my Aunt Mindy. I'd call on Monday and say, can I come for lunch on Shabbos? And then by Wednesday, I'd call and say, you know what, I have something else to do. And then Friday afternoon, I'd call back and say, can I come for lunch on Shabbos? And the answer was always yes. You know, it was never, you told me you weren't coming. But so having that kind of access to his pulpit and to his table was transformative.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Erica, you also write about Rabbi Lamb's sermons, specifically the 5-volume collected set of Drashot LeDorot, but even more so, much more expansively, the digital Lamb Heritage Archive, which is managed by our friend and colleague, Rabbi Tzvi Sinensky, and which was such an important resource for, I think, for all of the authors that wrote in the volume to be able to access his thousands of sermons. He was such a meticulous preparer of his sermons. Each one was typed out, and they have all been digitized and are all available online. And we encourage our readers and our listeners to dip into that fabulous resource of he who was the peerless, what he called himself, the unrepentant Darshan. You and I, of course, are not members of the family, and we didn't grow up at his knee listening to the sermons. We encountered him later, you and I both around the same time as students in Yeshiva University, and then through his writings. And you write about this kind of deep dive into the digital archives, where some of the sermons have actually been scanned, and we have the manuscript pages. He, in the days when rabbis had secretaries that would dutifully type out their manuscript, and then his pencil markings and his erasures and rearranging of paragraphs, polishing. I imagine him, you know, Friday late in the afternoon, as candle lighting is getting closer. He's polishing and he's revising and up until the last moment. And then I also imagine him to be on Saturday night revising the manuscript to reflect what was actually said, the idea that came to him at the last minute. So tell me about that encounter. That's not the way that we usually encounter the Dvarim Shebaal Peh, the oral teachings of great masters that have been passed down to us in writing. What was that kind of encounter with the texts like?
Yeah,
for you.
So first of all, before I answer that question, Jeff, I want to thank you on behalf of all the contributors for the investment that you made in making this possible. And I have to say, when it arrived, I just couldn't put it down. I read one essay after the other, and I learned from each one of them a slightly different perspective, sometimes a confirmation, sometimes new information. So I just want to thank you, because it's such a beautiful collection and it's treasured. And I actually gave a copy of it to someone just last night who was a congregant of Rabbi Lamb's, had seen the book for the first time and started remembering what it was like to be a young girl in his congregation. He hovered over her and talked about her learning, always asked about it, suggested teachers, suggested subjects. So that was just the long tail of what this book will give mm-hmm. people. So thank you.
Thank you.
So I have a somewhat of a unique perch in the sense that I was a student. Many people can claim that. He did teach for a little while at Stern, so I had the benefit of having him as a teacher. I have never, Ari, had the gift of being at his table or sitting and hearing him give a sermon, but I did, I was the community scholar in the Jewish Center for 3.5 years, so I did have the privilege of standing in that pulpit, and it's a very, very daunting moment. And it really made all of the scribbles and ephemera on his speeches, which I had seen before the archives were digitalized, and then really just so appreciated that other people could have that experience of seeing his material and understanding the iterative process of what it means to be a good darshan, of thinking not only about the language as he's writing it, but how each word is landing. So there's a certain craftsmanship in that, you know, the vocalization of it, the breath. Of, you know, when you're saying something and saying, is that a word that someone's going to understand? You know, having grown up as all of us did in the shadow of Rav Soloveitchik's teachings and been taught by so many people who are students, you know, words erstwhile and Weltanschauung and these big words, but Rabbi Lam, for the most part, did not use those words. I think he understood that his impact, that kind of impact, intellectual impact, would be reserved for his more scholarly books. As a pulpit rabbi, he spoke the language of the people and yet elevated it. So there was always, you know, there's a sense that he was taking you into the range where you could enter with him because that's where you were. And then he was carrying you up to someplace. And you can really, if you study his drashot, his sermons, you really appreciate the lyricism of them and the composition of them, almost like a symphonic experience where he was taking you somewhere and he was very conscious of that. And so I actually, I don't want to disagree with you, Jeff, we've been friends since high school. I don't think that he made corrections on Friday afternoon. I think he made corrections on Monday afternoon. Right. In fact, I'm friends with Ari Lam, and Ari, as a young rabbi himself, would go to his grandfather to prepare. And it was not a last minute, you know, they always joke that that the sermon was created in however many minutes it took for the rabbi to walk to shul. That is not the case. I have a sense, you know, not only did he do that for his own sermons, but then when he was reviewing his grandson's sermons, was sort of thinking with him about the weight. You know, in Hebrew, the weight, a word is a davar, it's a thing, you know, has thingness. I think that he sensed the materiality of language and how it would land.
That's interesting. Well, I want to actually now pitch a question to both of you. You know, Ari, who perhaps had a longer history as a consumer, as a listener, as an audience member, a congregant, and Erica, you and I coming to it a little bit later. But now all of us as consumers of Rabbi Lam's drashot, which must be distinguished from his more programmatic essays and books. These are all matters which begin in orality. They're prepared as speeches, as sermons meant to be delivered, and the turns of phrases are going to be different, and the emphases are going to be different, and the audience is going to be quite different. He was speaking at the beginning of his career when he was the rabbi in Springfield, Massachusetts, and then later at the Jewish Center when American Orthodoxy and the population of the Jewish Center was quite different than it is today. He had an agenda. There was a didactic agenda. There was a philosophical agenda he was trying to advance. There were social issues he was trying to promote. We, having the ability to hear his voice in our head, read the texts as oral artifacts. Sometimes when I've spent a lot of time in the last year in the preparation of this book, reading his many writings, rereading things that I've known for years and encountering essays that I had never had a chance to read before, and I hear his voice in my head. I sometimes even catch myself during the Purim spiel version, imitating his very distinctive voice.
Yeah.
And I think we all-
A little higher pitched.
I think that we all, have caught ourselves doing that, but the books exist now as static documents on the shelf. And in generations to come, our children and our children's children will encounter them as written texts. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about the difference between consuming them as pieces of orality, even though they're black and white on the page, versus those who will come and encounter them just as merely written texts, and how that is going to affect their significance and their legacy. And Ari.
Well, I would say that they stand up, that they may have been written and delivered 40, 50 years ago, but they're still relevant, and the issues that they engage still touch us. And I think that's why this whole project exists. That's why all his sermons are online, so that we can touch that that greatness and that relevance. I think we do have an advantage of people as people who are able to hear him and be there. And when you were talking earlier, Jeff, about his the nature of the work that he put into them and how he would write them. He once told me that every speech is three speeches.
You mentioned this in the piece.
Yeah. You know, there's the sermon you intend to give, there's the sermon that you give, and then there's the sermon that you wish you gave. And I often feel that as a teacher, as a writer, not so much as a writer because I can revise, but once something's published, you can't always go back and change it. They're living documents. There were living documents for him. How, it's a really good question about someone who didn't have that opportunity to hear him, and how they can, how they can experience them. I'd say one advantage he has over a lot of previous generations is that we have the videotape. We have tapes of him talking. Yeah. We can hear him. I'm reminded somewhat of when I go to Kasba Deli on the Upper West Side, and they have videos
the Rebbe
of
playing on a loop.
Rebbe, in a loop, and you could, you know, the Rebbe still lives there. You know, Rabbi Lam still lives on videotape and in his sermons. So, I think, you know, I was privileged to hear him growing up, even though I didn't always appreciate him. I even remember when he was rabbi in Springfield, mm-hmm. and I would hear him in the 1950s. My first memories when I was 5 years old and I was at Norman and Mindy's wedding, if I could say that, my aunt and uncle's wedding. I remember that in Springfield, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. So, I would say there's no way to replicate that experience, but to read this volume, I think comes pretty close. And I'll echo Erica, you did a beautiful job as a tribute to him and as a living legacy.
And Erica, do you have any thoughts on this?
I do. Like Ari, I have many friends who are writers, and someone will tell me, you know, that a book that they read of a friend of mine, what a wonderful book. And when I read it, it plays like an audio tape because I'm hearing the voice of that person. But it doesn't mean that it's not wonderful. It's just, for me, it's a little more wonderful because there's an oracular quality to it that also personalizes it. I'm not a person who, maybe it's because of my age, who likes texting. I like sending voice notes and I like receiving voice notes because to me, the voice is a signature aspect of someone's personality. And I can tell, maybe this is the teacher in me, when someone is slightly sad or there's a little bounce in a voice. And I think one of the things that Rabbi Lam had, which you cannot get without the voice, is the passion. You can sometimes sense that he must have said this with Mark Twain's dramatic pause, but you don't know that. But you can imagine that he said that. And he was passionate about his delivery. And I think one of the problems with the oracular culture we find ourselves in is the casual nature of it. People say things without thinking, you know, what are the long-term impacts? And then of course it's, you know, captured on video or something and it lives on forever. They don't, because of the oral quality of something, we don't always think about the seriousness of it. Right. And then you just say, well, God created the world with voice first. God gave the Aseret Hadibrot not only in stone, but in the booming voice. And so I don't want to diminish or minimize the significance of the voice that's attached to this. And there's something I want to say that maybe is not fair and maybe it's a little radical. I think a lot of rabbis today are afraid of their congregants. You know, there's a cancel culture that is very threatening. Lots of people in leadership positions walk on eggshells. When I read Rabbi Lam's sermons, I have a sense that he was not afraid of his congregants. He understood right. that he had to mentor his congregants, and it was his job because people were not perhaps going to hear this somewhere else. Yes, you need to learn more. Yes, you need to send your kids to Jewish day school. Yes, your homes need to be kosher. Yes, you need to act counterculturally. And sometimes the emphatic nature of that doesn't come out only in the words. It comes out in the marriage of words to the tonality of the word. And I think that is something that we won't get, is not only is the passion of the language and also the sense that own these words. Don't be afraid to say them. Don't be afraid of your congregation. Stretch your congregation, take them to someplace they didn't think they could go. That's really what a leader does.
That theme actually is given full analysis in two essays in the volume. First by Richard Joel, Rabbi Lam's successor as president of Yeshiva, in a kind of general essay about Rabbi Lam's writings on leadership, and particularly in our old friend Menachem Penner, the head of Reitz, analyzed Rabbi Lam's sermons or speeches, addresses at the Chagei Smicha, when they were minting the new rabbis and sending them out to the world over the years. What were the messages that he was trying to send them off into the world with? And that particular note was sounded very, very crystal clear in those addresses. I think that he, in the sermons, as in the more direct programmatic essays, he's both teaching and preaching, and he's trying to elevate and elucidate and educate, but he's also trying to emote.
I would add that he in his sermons, they were pitched right above your head. I mentioned this in my essay.
Yeah. Wanted the audience to reach, to stretch.
He wanted you to stretch, to reach, right? The royal reach one of his themes. Right. He didn't give us the pablum or easy answers. He challenged himself, you could feel, and he challenged his congregation. And you had a reach. The essays that I wrote about were the book that I wrote about was the Yisker sermons. Mm-hmm. And I felt there he went right for the heart. He wanted to touch you in a different way. So they're not as challenging intellectually, but they're challenging emotionally. And they demand a lot of the listener.
Right. So yeah. Obviously in the Yisker sermons, particularly delivered to an audience, many of whom came to synagogue in those days only for Yisker. Mm-hmm. That was the actual real pull. And it was good that they didn't even really understand what's in the Yisker, what the meaning of Kaddish is, because it would have lost some of the pull and some of the magic. But the emotional, what you write about the emotional range, and Ari, what you write about, obviously in the Yisker sermons, Erica, you pick up on this motif of crying, and you follow it like a through line over sermons that were delivered over many decades. In one, you point out he references the Kotzker Rebbe, who was a particular had particular affection for the Kotzker. As a matter of fact, Tzvi Sinensky's essay in the volume focuses specifically on the presence of Kotzk in his sermons. But you pick up on a particular sermon in which he quotes the Kotzker Rebbe, who said that when a man needs to cry and wants to cry but cannot cry, that is the most heartrending cry of all. And it's only the Kotzker could have said that, and only Rabbi Lam could have delivered it with such force in this particular drasha that you're analyzing. But tell me a little bit how you came to this idea of let's try to get into this. You had a daunting task, much more so than some of the other authors in the volume who were assigned, sometimes very specific essays, sometimes brief essays. We asked you to survey the whole sermonic opera. And you chose to view it through this prism of tears and crying. How did you come to that, and what did you discover?
I think it's a great question, Jeff, and I'm glad you asked it, because it brings to bear another point that Ari touched upon, but not specifically in this way. Rabbi Lam picked very interesting texts to teach about. And I find that I hear sermons are sent to me, and sometimes, you know, you called it pablum ari. I call it like the march of the cliches with a certain Jewish text that, you know, we like, please don't quote the Tanur Shelachnai again, right? It was like, I can't, you know, and I could go through a few of them that appear again and again. And I always felt that what Rabbi Lam was doing, he really was never condescending to his audience. You won't understand this, so I have to give you something that's overly familiar. He would choose Jewish texts, particular details in a biblical story, a rabbinic text, a piece of Hasidic thought that people had not been exposed to. And I had used the sermon that was the basis of my essay was something I used many, many years ago. I was struck by the generational, the way that he was trying to take a generation of American Jews, particularly in the 60s and 70s, who for whom synagogue was very formal and church-like. And he was trying to, in a way, take you to the shtiebel of Eastern Europe. And so when he talked about this, that particular sermon, he talked about machzorim, which you would open up on the high holidays, on the days of awe, and they would be, you could see that someone had cried into them, sort of the way that wine spills on a page of Haggadah. And that's the legacy, is when you pick that up, there's a sense, there's a history there, there's a feeling of connection. You're at the nexus of those who came before you and those who come after you, but yet we've lost that sort of Eastern European warmth, which I think in his writing about Hasidic literature was in many ways to bring his congregants and to bring others into, this is not a dyspeptic sort of sterile spiritual landscape. We need to give people that sense of warmth and humanity. And so I found that tears were a natural place. You know, there's a, like the salinity of them, like how does that, the universality of them, how does that continue across the ages? I also want to say, because I don't want to forget, Ari, you talked about the royal reach. So I was very taken by Rabbi Penner's, as you could see, I put stickies all over this book and intend to reference so many things. And I just wanted to say, to repeat something that Rabbi Penner so movingly says. He talks about, you know, the way that Rabbi Lam, not to his congregants, but to future rabbis, he cites one of Rabbi Lam's early addresses in 1983, to the Chag HaSmicha, the makings of a Ben Torah. And he said that Musmachim needed to minimally remain B'nai Torah. So this wasn't only a message to congregants, stretch yourself. He was saying this to rabbis. The day you stop studying, the day you stop climbing the road to Torah excellence is the day you are no longer a Ben Torah. And that day, all that is written on your rabbinic diploma is rendered meaningless. And I found that so powerful, because basically he was saying, if you don't have a lot of input, you will never have a lot of output. And if you don't model this, if you think that you've reached, you know, just you've got a degree and you're stopping here, then what is the project here? What is the enterprise? And that notion that all of us who represent Torah have to be B'nai Torah. And that means a constant life of learning before teaching. And I think he does that in his sermons. He sort of takes you to a place where he says, I continue learning, and I'm going to learn with you when I'm teaching. I'm not going to condescend to you. I'm learning with you. That always struck me as something very beautiful about his writing.
It's wonderful to hear Erica invoke the shtiebel, because the Jewish Center was anything but
the shtiebel. And you know, Rabbi, they replaced the pews, Ari. I don't know if you know that they replaced the pews recently, those uncomfortable wooden pews, with the same exact pews.
Right.
Tradition.
I mean, in my day, and I don't know if they do it anymore, but in my day, they wore top hats.
They do.
At the Jewish Center and formal, in order to go up on the Bima, if you were an officer, you dressed formally.
Yes.
And yet,
with no irony, it's with done no irony. With absolute right. seriousness. Right.
And think about like 1950s, 1960s Orthodoxy or Judaism. It was very much to be Protestant. It was very much to be in the like Temple Emmanuel was the model. We had to be more Protestant than the Protestants. And I think the Jewish Center was modeled on something very different than the shtiebel, but yet Rabbi Lam, when he opened his mouth, when he talked Torah, when he talked about crying, he invoked that world and mm-hmm. somehow made them come together. You also mentioning the sort of the countercultural aspects of his teaching, and I'll cite another essay in this volume by Tova Sinensky about a hedge of roses.
Yes.
And how
we should mention Tova Sinensky is, of course, Rabbi and Mrs. Lam's granddaughter, and she's a distinguished Yoetzet Halacha working in the United States.
Yeah, yeah. And she writes about how brave it was to come out with a book like that in the 1960s when this Torah HaMishpacha was not something that people talked about, or it was very much, very much in the bedroom and very much against the popular culture, and that he took this on knowing that he was, you know, going against you know, the prevailing winds. And that book, I think she really puts it very beautifully. The book is often seen as sort of apologetics, but with time it has become part of a larger movement, how this issue is more talked about, it's more observed, it's more it's seen in a different context, and Tova's work and the work of these Yoetzet Halacha are, you know, very much, you know, sort of taking it into a modern era that could not have been done without Rabbi Lam's pioneering work in this area, which again, you know, evoked the Shtiebel, but yet fit in to the modern context.
So it's funny, Ari, I remember getting that book. Maybe I was a bride or close to, I don't know, when I was, not that they gave them out in Stern, but I remember feeling that this was, even the size, it was very small. And I felt like it was sort of like, you know, it had a sale by date, right? By the time that, you know, I had read it, it felt out of date. And I appreciated in Tova's piece that sometimes, you know, we look at leaders and we judge them for not being as woke as we are, or not as aware, or not as sensitive to certain cultural winds, and not thinking that how radical they were in their time. And I appreciate what you said, because I think it's easy to judge a legacy and date a legacy without understanding just how revolutionary some of the things that Rabbi Lam did in the days in which he did them.
I thought that Tova's essay was present company excluded. I thought it was really among the best in the volume. And I thought she did something really very subtle and innovative in taking this, you know, frankly, old text and showing how path-breaking it was, not only because he was, you know, perhaps the first to make such an argument for Torah HaMishpacha and Hilchot Nida and family purity in American Judaism, but the way that through her reading, you see how this kind of philosophical text and even popular philosophy aimed at a general audience intersected very much and emanated out of a certain halachic conception. And for a work to sit at that intersection of halacha and agadah, or philosophy and law, was in the time was path breaking, but even today is a model that we need more of. And I thought that her essay does a very good job of kind of unraveling how he did that and what its significance as a model, which, you know, might have been applied to any other area of Jewish thought or halacha.
But look at these two brothers and what they contributed, because Maurice Lam wrote the book on death and dying. That you still see death and mourning, yes. Yeah. That you still see on people's in Shabbat.
Yeah, it was only very recently reissued or issued in Hebrew. A new Hebrew edition is available here in Israel.
It's interesting. There's so many books that have been eclipsed by other books on the same topic, and that has a certain persistence. You know, you do see it still in Shiva homes, and you know, and people reading it. It's almost like you don't need something else. You have it. You know. This contains what it needs to contain.
Well, certainly Hedge of Roses went, I think probably more than any of his other books, went to more printings and more editions and translated into mm-hmm. every language where there's a Jewish community. Into Portuguese and Spanish and Russian and French and Spanish and German and et cetera. I want to kind of just wrap up by coming back to this idea, Erica, that you touched on and you as well, Ari, that he pushed us to reach, but he also didn't fear, certainly not in the format of the sermon, to come down to earth to the people. In an essay, Ari, that you quote about those who live and those who live on. What does it mean to achieve immortality, meaning that your legacy should live on? So he cites certain figures like Moses and Rabbi Akiva and Maimonides, and also he adds to their number Rembrandt, Shakespeare, and Einstein, all people who live on. There's a well-known, perhaps apocryphal story about Rabbi Soloveitchik, that somebody, there was some event, it was the 700th anniversary of the Rambam's death, or something like that, and somebody asked Rabbi Soloveitchik if he wanted to go to participate in this event for the 700th anniversary, 700th Yahrzeit of Rambam, and he looked up and he said, "It never occurred to me that he was dead." and that's true for these great figures. That's true of these great figures that Rabbi Lam catalogs in his Drasha. And we should, I guess, say that he himself has joined that pantheon of those whose legacy will live on. So these are people who have achieved deathlessness, he says. And then you quote him as saying, turning to the audience, we can, those of us that can hear the voice can imagine the pause. And he looks down and he says, "What, however, of us common folk, including himself with his parishioners? What of us who don't rank with Moses and Maimonides and Einstein and Shakespeare? What of those we memorialize, meaning the people for whom we've come to recite Yizkor today, the Mamas and the Tatis and the Babas and the Zaydis, to speak in the Yiddish that many of the congregants would have heard and resonated with? Talented, perhaps, but they were not geniuses. Well-liked, yes, but not world famous. Can people who are good, kind, but largely undistinguished in the course of usual uneventful lives be said to be able to achieve immortality?" And then he offers an answer which allows us, those that remain behind, to feel our loved ones once again, which is, of course, the title of your piece, picking up from that theme. So this kind of image of the high on the mountain and down in the trenches and being able to make that subtle turn on a dime within one short rhetorical space, I think is a wonderful example of this. But there's another element which is true throughout his work, not just the sermons, but in his communal work and in his leadership of the community and of the university and in his very many significant substantive philosophical books and essays, which of course are a very different genre than the sermon. This kind of tension between up and down. Sometimes he was criticized. Sometimes Yeshiva University was criticized that this idea of Torah Umada, which we haven't touched on here, and others will discuss this idea of Torah Umada, is a very hyper-intellectualized bar that he wanted us all to pass. And not everybody is a little religious philosopher. Not everyone is a 20th century, early 21st century Maimonides, who he once said, were he alive today, would certainly be teaching on the faculty of Yeshiva University. Where else would he teach? And nevertheless, the ability to prod and to push and to move in his very well-known and significant speech, which now we, of course, consume as an article, Notes of an Unrepentant Darshan, where he takes his fellow rabbis to task for neglecting the sermonic arts. One of the things he seems most disturbed with is the kind of dumbing down of the sermon. Erica, you kind of touched on this a few minutes ago, the idea that the homiletic arts have been neglected. They become either a place, a dumping ground for some lumdus, right? Where in the name of raising the bar of intense, perhaps Talmudic analysis, the rabbi will use the sermon as a kind of opportunity to deliver a mini she'ur, which has integrity and has rules of its own, but it's a different game, right? It might be a game that's playing in the adjacent arena, but a she'ur is different than a sermon. And he feared that that was being lost. And perhaps it was being lost. Perhaps he mourned its loss because it's specifically in the sermon that the preacher, the teacher, is able to make this kind of vertical movement up and down, from the weighty ideas to the people, particularly at a time when some of those people in the pews were simple Jews. I mean that with all of the honor deserving to a Yehudi Pashut, to a simple Jew. It's not so simple to be a simple Jew, and it was even harder to be a simple Jew in those decades when Torah true Judaism, when Orthodoxy was struggling for its survival. And it was because of the efforts of the likes of Rabbi Lam and others that we inherited a Judaism and an Orthodoxy that looks so much different, almost unimaginable to what those people in the pews might have noted. So I'm curious what you each think of this kind of, you know, movement back and forth, how it played out specifically in the Drashot, maybe perhaps in the Drashot that you saw. And Eric, I want to start with you because in your essay, you conclude with a rather personal story of a struggle that you went through as a teacher and preacher, and how the encounter with Rabbi Lam's model was useful to you, and how the personal encounter with Rabbi Lam was useful.
Yeah, I appreciate the way that you articulated that, Jeff. I think for me, the chidush of writing the article, and I thank you for tasking me with it, because it enabled me to really sit with the sermons in a way I had not sat with them before, and recognize their significance as the ultimate expression of a Torah Mada lifestyle. I think as a student of Yeshiva University, and I mentioned in the piece, receiving, which I don't think they give out sadly today, an anthology, right? The anthology of articles.
I still, it's right up there on my shelf.
Yeah, on Torah Umada, and with Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Soloveitchik and Eliezer Berkowitz, right? But so there were a selection of articles. Maybe we would add some to some of those articles at the time. But I remember receiving this sort of bundle and with an expectation, figure this out. Modern Orthodoxy is a really demanding intellectual enterprise. And I think because it's been, as you rightly said, hyper-intellectualized, it set a bar that very few people can really achieve, right? Unless you're going to continue really doing the difficult work of integration, of the cognitive dissonance sometimes, of walking in these arenas that demand a different mindset perhaps, and different behaviors. And what I think was the genius of Rabbi Lam, and when you talk about the immortality, it really was, for me, it's the sermon, because I think the sermon says, this is where the rubber hits the road. If this project of centrist orthodoxy, as he preferred to call it, is really going to work, it's going to be every Shabbat in the experience of putting our worlds together, a current event, a simcha or a loss in a family, and whatever the parsha was of that week, the Torah reading, if those can come together for you in an electrifying way, and you can carry that home and repeat that at your Shabbat table, then centrist orthodoxy is going to be okay. But when you can't do that, because where the rabbi is, the clergy is, and where the congregant is, it's too far apart, it's not going to work. And I think his training of rabbis and his blessing of rabbis at the Chag HaSmicha was really in some way saying, look at me. He would never have said that, but it was, this is the real work. It's not to be in the Beit Midrash, and it's not to be in the library. It's to be in a synagogue, to live with people and bring these ideas to them so that this can be a movement. And I think we take that, that movement for granted. I can say that I am the beneficiary of wonderful sermons today from my rabbi, Rabbi Bram Weinberg, who was an intern at the Jewish Center. And I'm sure that because of that, he understood This is the legacy and this is the responsibility. And how do you make this live in people's lives? And I hope that that one of the enduring gifts of Rabbi Lam will be the challenge for every rabbi to say, this is what we need to do when we're teaching. We're giving Torah Umada to the people. And that's really what Torah Umada, that's where its best expression is.
If I can quote you back to yourself, you end this section of your essay by saying, I finally realized that Torah Umada can only succeed ideologically if it can compel emotionally.
Yes.
Ari, I stand Goldberg. By that. Okay. You second the motion.
I will wrap up with a confession, and that is, I wasn't asked to be part of this volume. I heard about it.
We were very glad to involve you.
I was not approached. I wasn't on the list somehow. And I don't know how they missed me, but I pursued Rabbi Jeff and said, you know, I have something to say.
He persisted.
I want to be part of this. And for our listeners, may that be a lesson to you. If you don't get the assignment you want, go talk to the editor. Go fight for it.
Editors are usually journal editors. I don't know about the New York Times editor with whom you used to interact. Journal editors are usually only too happy to have people volunteer to write.
Yeah, begging.
Well, I spent many years at the New York Times fighting for stories. I want that story and fighting off other reporters who wanted the story. So I'm kind of scrappy when it comes to things like this. But I mention that because I feel like I have many things that I'm proud of in my life, but one of the most is that I'm a Talmud of Rabbi Lam, and to connect with him and to be part of this volume was important to me, to be part of his legacy. I love that Erica held up her book and showed, you know, all the stickers in it. I'm going through it, but I started with all the family members. And Jeff mentioned that many family members contributed. So starting with Mark Dratch, who's his son-in-law, two of his grandsons-in-law, Zvi Sinensky and Mark Halpern, who are married to
Stu Halpern.
I'm Stu Halpern, right? And Sam Dratch, who's his grandson.
And Tova
Sinensky.
What a legacy, right?
Yeah. And I think that is incredible. If we think about, you know, what we want to leave, we'll leave students, but we want to leave, you know, children and nieces and nephews and and generations of people who remember our work and continue our work. Yeah. So there's so much in this volume to enjoy. But I started with the mishpacha and the connections and the personal connections. Erica talks about the emotional range of his sermons. And that's true across the board, but it's also true in each sermon has that emotional range. He takes you from a point almost of questioning. He'll engage you intellectually, and then he'll challenge you. He'll even threaten you. What Jeff did with in recounting that sermon about immortality, he's threatening you. He's saying, you're not Rembrandt, you're not Moses. Who do you think you are? And then and there's like a discomfort you feel. And then he brings it home and there's a resolution and there's a warmth and there's hope at the end. What Erica said about bringing something home from shul is all I want when I go to shul. I want to take something home. I want one piece of Torah, one thing that I could repeat at my Shabbos table. And Rabbi Lam never failed to give you something to take home. May his memory be for a blessing. He was an incredible man, And all of us are his Talmidim. All of us are his family, in a sense. And he gave each of us so much.
We've been talking about his sermons in our conversation today. In the opening to my introduction to the volume, I ask, how many others could lay claim to a lasting legacy as a rabbi, preacher and teacher, scholar and writer, public intellectual and spokesman, thinker and philosopher, university president and Rosh HaYeshiva, and many other roles as well? Well, the answer, of course, is there really is no one else. He really was peerless in that regard. And I'm particularly proud of how we assembled the volume, that we took the legacy of his written works, some that began as speeches and were later turned into written works, and we assigned them to people instead of a kind of collection of essays. You know, very often memorial essays are, you know, memorial volumes are uneven collections of essays where people either write about what interests them or something connected to the dearly departed. But here we assembled 35 people to write about 35 different works. And I don't think we covered every single thing, but certainly all of the major volumes left behind on the shelf. And through the volume, the reader, it's a reader's guide to Rabbi Lam's thinking and teaching and preaching and contributions to our intellectual life, which he was so instrumental, of course, in shaping. And his influence will be felt for many decades and generations to come. So while we were today talking about the sermons, the reader of the memorial volume will also be able to dip into his other works, his works of more proper Torah scholarship, and his works of Lumdus, his works of philosophy. David Schatz writes about his contributions in science. He began his career as a scientist, and write about science, also science fiction, the religious implications of extraterrestrial life, and his involvement, believe it or not, in 2001: A Space Odyssey, which is such a fascinating little chapter in his biography. So the reader will find so many things in the volume, and we invite you to visit traditiononline.org, where you can order your copy. Subscribers have, or hopefully soon will, receive their copy in the mail, and it's a perfect time to subscribe to Tradition for this and for so many of the other things that we're doing and publishing, both in print and online at traditiononline.org. We've been talking with Ari Goldman about his essay, To Feel Our Loved Ones Once Again, which explored memory and meaning, the Korain Yizkor, edited by our friend and colleague, we should mention, Joel Wolowelski, and with Erica Brown about her essay, The Emotional Range of Rabbi Lam's Sermons, which explored the entire genre of sermons in Rabbi Lam's life, particularly through the prism of the Drasha LeDorot series, 5 volumes from Magid Books, and the very significant resource, which is the Lam Heritage Archive online, housing the texts of thousands of his sermons. And you can also, of course, access many of the audio and video recordings of different speeches, although not those delivered in the pulpit of the Jewish Center on Shabbat. So Erica and Ari, thank you very much. And thank you to our listeners.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.